Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome back. If you were with us in the first hour, and if you just joined us, I'd like to let you know this is a two-hour show where we balance the creative with the intellectual and try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. And we do this by featuring thought-provoking conversations out and about with people on the street in the first hour of the show. And then in the second hour, we carry out in-depth interviews with inspiring special guests from the arts. If you'd like more information about the show, you can go to the website. It's a questionofbalance.com. There's podcasts of all my previous shows there. I've had some great topics and some wonderful arts guests. So again, that's itsaquestionofbalance.com if you'd like to check those out. This week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Bonnie Greenberg, award-winning music supervisor, executive music producer, jewelry designer, and college professor. Bonnie, referred to by Michael Rogers, was one of the elite superstar music supervisors, has been at the forefront of entertainment, integrating music and motion pictures for over two decades. Bonnie has been integrally involved with over 80 films spanning all budgets and genres, from documentaries such as Marilyn, independent films such as Spanking the Monkey, Hairspray, Menace to Society, and Lars and the Real Girl, mid-budget, independent, and studio films such as Dead Presidents, The Best Man, The Mask, Rat Race, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, and Pleasantville, to major studio blockbusters including My Best Friend's Wedding, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, What Women Want, The Santa Claus, Something's Gotta Give, and It's Complicated, to the hit TV series Desperate Housewives. She has worked repeatedly with established directors such as Jerry Zucker, Ron Howard, Malcolm Lee, PJ Hogan, Nancy Myers, and the Hughes Brothers, and consulted for Sydney Kimmel Entertainment, overseeing the music in all their original productions. Most recently, she was one of the producers of the made-for-TV original musical film Dear Dumb Diary, the independent film Halfway, and the controversial documentary The Hunting Ground about sexual assault on US college campuses. Bonnie also just completed post-production on another original feature film musical entitled Basmati Blues and starring Brie Larson, Donald Sutherland, and Scott Bakula. Bonnie features in the book How I Broke Into Hollywood, Tales from the Trenches, and also appears in many music documentaries, including for CNN and VH1. She has produced or executive produced numerous gold and platinum soundtrack albums and received an NAACP Award for Album of the Year for her work on The Best Man. Bonnie is a firm believer that music should enhance and support the visual images of film and is a frequent lecturer on the use of music in films as an adjunct professor at UCLA Graduate Film School teaching music supervision. Having started her career in the entertainment industry, working as an attorney and then business affairs executive at MCA Records Inc. and Paramount Pictures, she's on the advisory board of the Donald E. Biederman Entertainment and Media Law Institute at Southwestern University School of Law. She's a 30-year member of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences and is one of the founding members of the Guild of Music Supervisors. In addition to her entertainment career, Bonnie is a jewelry designer producing unconventional one-off pieces. Welcome to the show, Bonnie.
Wow, that was some introduction. I wish my parents could hear it. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. Maybe they can listen to the podcast afterwards.
It would be tough. Unfortunately, they're no longer with us, but I know they're listening from somewhere else.
Oh, yes, let's hope so. I'm sure they're very proud of you. It's an amazing career. You've spent decades immersed in music and film. I'm wondering if you can remember the first time that art had a real effect on you, where you realized it could be more than entertainment, that it also had a power to move people on a deep level.
Oh, my, that would probably go back to my childhood. I used to go to musical theater with my father all the time, starting from around age 7.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was one of 4 girls, but somehow I was the one. It was clear that I had this musical thing, and I would go to these shows with him, and I would be so mesmerized that at intermission, I would go hang out over the orchestra pit and try and talk to the different players. And this is when I was 7, 8, 9, 10, and but just want to watch and listen to how they created that music that was so amazing to me.
Yeah.
So early on, my experience with art was through theater and music as opposed to, you know, art museums. They didn't impact me the same way.
Right.
It was much more about storytelling. I had no idea that that would enter into my life later on as a career. It was just something I loved. I mean, literally, I would hang over the orchestra pit. And look at the guys.
That's so cute.
That's great. And then I would try, and then they'd have to come kick me out and send me back to the seat when the show would start again, because I'd actually want to stay there.
Uh-huh.
And now, of course, I do that with my daughter. I've been taking her since she was 7. So.
Oh. And did they talk to you? I mean, were they open
to
that?
Oh, yeah, they couldn't believe I had a little kid. Absolutely. And they would show me the music, and they would talk to me about their different instruments and tell me about how often they practice and how they became, how they got to play in an orchestra for theater and... Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
I don't think there were many little kids who were that interested in what they were doing. I mean, the orchestra from the original theater is kind of the unsung hero. I mean, at the end, you know, after they take the bows, the actors always put their arm out and point to the orchestra and everyone claps. But really, they're hidden below.
Yeah.
You know, they're like in the basement, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of this mysterious original music that comes from who knows where. Yeah.
And I still do it. I'll still go down to a pit, you know, on the shows that have live orchestras. I'll still do it at the end of the show or at intermission. Intermission, they'll tend to run off, you know, get their coffee. And at the end of the show, when they're packing up their instruments and packing up their sheet music, I'll still go there and talk to them. I find it incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So your father took you. I was going to ask you, did you grow up in a creative environment, would you say? It sounds like maybe you did.
I interestingly wouldn't have thought that because my father was a lawyer and my mother was like a housewife, was more of an athlete, which so was I. Mm. But my father also actually painted as a hobby painter. I don't know that it soaked in when I was a kid because I actually do that now too. But certainly he did that all through till he died. He always painted.
Mm.
And he was very into musical theater. But I would never have thought that I lived in an artistic household at the time. And my older sister was an artist. I mean, not professionally, but I mean, growing up in high school, she was a great artist.
Mm.
But I was more a musician. I started playing music when I was a little child.
Ah, what music? What did you get into?
Well, I first started playing the piano when I was 5. And then in my elementary school, when we still had school music programs, which unfortunately many schools don't, I'm trying to do my part to change that a little, throw that in.
Mm.
In my school, in 1st and 2nd grade, you could play string instrument. That's what you could take through school. So I took up violin, and I was horrendous. It was not until I was an adult that I realized a violin was a beautiful instrument, because my experience sounded... I don't think I ever got a note out of a violin. So I played violin very unsuccessfully for 1st and 2nd grade.
Yeah.
And in 3rd grade, they announced you could take woodwind. So I switched to flute. And then I still pretty much play the flute, but not... as a regular instrument, but I've played the flute since 3rd grade.
Right. Yeah.
And then in about 10th grade, I took up harp. You know, and of course I did recorder and guitar like every child, you know, kid did back then.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Music was perhaps more part of the fabric of education then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you...
I have to say... doing a telephone interview, you know, I have the worst New York accent. I'm very self-conscious. So all you people out there, try not to make fun of me in person. You wouldn't feel it.
You sound fine to me, Bonnie, so don't worry. I've got my own accent going on, you know, so we we'll play off each other with a differing accent. Did you consider creating music yourself, writing music?
No. I did forget. This isn't so much about music, but in terms of your artistic question. So I realized my mother was not a fine artist like a painter, but my mother knit and sewed and did all those things, which actually those are considered, you know, artistic and creative. And I started knitting when I was in 4th grade. In 5th grade, I had a little business where I crocheted vests and sold them to people. And at school.
Oh, that's so resourceful.
So I guess from that sense, there was I had never perceived my mother that way, but she actually, I guess, knitting and sewing and creating all those ideas from her head was also artistic. In terms of writing my own music, no. Never been interested. And I don't know if I should share the story. Actually, I will. When I was at some point, when I became a music supervisor and I was working in the field, I thought it would really be interesting to learn more the whole process of how composers work. I mean, this was very early on. I'd done one or two films. So there was a course offered at UCLA Extension for film composers, you know, for people who wanted to become film composers. So I took the class, and right from the first class, I walked up to the professor, and I said, listen, I'm not interested in being a film composer. I'm taking this class more to learn the process and what they go through so I can understand it better, because I work with composers as a music supervisor. Mm. But I'm not interested in learning how to compose music. In fact, now I wish I had done it then, to tell you the truth. Mm. But I'd only done a movie or two, and I was young, and I didn't think that it was something that I wanted to learn about. So I take the whole class, and at the end of the class, that you have to have a private session with the professor at his home. Mm. So when I get, and he, it was almost like a shrink session, to be honest with you. So I'm at his house, and he said, we really need to deal with this fact of your avoidance of trying to be a film composer. I said, no, it's really not an avoidance. I'm just not interested. He said, no, but we really should delve into why you're not interested. I said, okay, I really want to share something with you. I am interested in so many things, way more things than your average human being, that I am thrilled to find something that doesn't interest me. This is not a denial. This is not fear. I'm just not interested, and I'm really happy that I'm not interested, because really, I have too many interests. Hmm. Now, of course, I'm saying to you, you know what? I should have learned how to do it. Now I'm kind of interested. But this was like 25 years ago, and it was like he wouldn't stop. No, really, let's delve. What's your fear? And I said, no, really, it's not a fear. Because just from your little brief intro, you can hear I kind of have a lot of interests.
Yes, yeah, that is
very
clear.
I was very happy to find one that didn't seem to be compelling my focus at that time. But no, so I had never, I'd say it wasn't until recently that I thought, if I was taking that class now, it'd be kind of interesting to learn to write that music. Yeah. So it's almost bizarre that I never was interested. I do write lyrics a lot. Mm. And always have. I used to make up songs as a kid.
Right.
But I've never tried to write music.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the interesting things in life when you are a continuous learner, which you obviously are, that the opportunities to do new things never end, you know. So if you wanted to, you still could, couldn't you? But as you say, you have covered a lot of ground in your life. So.
Yeah, I just started a collage class I take on Fridays now.
Oh, excellent. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, Bonnie Greenberg, award-winning music supervisor, executive music producer, jewelry designer, and college professor. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
The music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
That is more to me. a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second-generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Bonnie Greenberg, award-winning music supervisor, executive music producer, jewelry designer, and college professor. So you began your career as a lawyer, Bonnie. I'm wondering what made you choose that rather than something in the arts.
Interesting you should ask that. growing up, I think I mentioned earlier, my father was a lawyer, and I was probably an argumentative, smart kid. And I was programmed, you're going to be a lawyer, you're going to be a lawyer, you're going to be a lawyer. And social studies in junior high school, I represented Robespierre in the French Revolution and got him off. And my social studies teacher even wrote in my yearbook, to Bonnie, who will make a good trial attorney. So it was kind of like, it was almost predetermined I was going to be a lawyer. I graduated high school young and college young. And my last, somehow in college, I got very involved with African literature and creative writing, and I no longer wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to write a novel and go to graduate school and be a PhD in creative writing and teach college. But there was this tremendous pressure. No, you're going to be a lawyer. You're going to be a lawyer. And my father, there's a famous joke about my father. My cousin at the eulogy, my father's funeral, said, I will miss my Uncle Merce. My dad's name was Morris, and his nickname was Merce. I will miss my Uncle Merce, as will all law schools across the United States of America. Because a running joke is if you walked into his office, he would get you enrolled in law school. It wasn't necessary to be a lawyer. He would say so that you should go to law school so that you know enough to know that your lawyers are full of whatever. Yeah. I don't know if we can curse on the airways.
We can't, no.
So, yeah, we came from a family where, you know, there was a value to going to law school. So somehow, my last year at school, and I changed my mind. My father said, look, that's a great plan, but you're only 20, because as I said, I graduated very young, and we're 19. You can always go back to school and do that. So that's it. So basically, I moved to California and went to law school, and that's what happened. And then I was in law school. I decided I wanted to be a legal aid lawyer, and then I couldn't handle how you have to rip people apart on the stand. It just, I didn't have the personality for it. And I thought, well, I love movies. I wrote movie reviews in high school, in the school newspaper. I was always a movie fanatic. I thought, well, maybe I can be a movie lawyer and ultimately learn to make movies. And that was kind of my plan, but I ended up getting a job at MCA, which was part of Universal. And I thought, oh, this is okay. I'll work at the record company and then segue over into the movies. That's kind of what happened with the law school thing.
So how did,
and it just wasn't really for me. It wasn't really for me being a lawyer.
Right, yeah, I could see that. How did you get into music supervision then from that? How did you segue into that?
Well, what happened when I was a music lawyer, I was a music lawyer and I worked at a record company. I was in business affairs at the record company. And I found myself that I was way too artist-oriented and not company-oriented. So it wasn't really the right job for someone like me.
Right.
So I decided I was going to quit, and everyone was pretty shocked. There was a regime change, and when the new regime came in and a lot of my friends were fired, it seemed like a good opportunity to quit. It was a bit of a shocker. So anyway, I ended up staying a while longer to help out, and probably had I not quit, I probably wouldn't have. I would have been too chicken to at that point because by now I was attached to all the new people. But luckily, I'd already quit. So I tried to get a job as someone's assistant to make movies because I still was pretty interested in making movies.
Yeah.
And no one wanted to hire me because I was, quote, unquote, overqualified.
Hmm.
Now, today those things have changed, but you know, this is 25 years ago. Now they're thrilled to have lawyers or executives come be your assistant. It's almost become more of a norm.
Mm.
But then no one wanted to hire me. So then finally someone said to me, they would hire me,
yeah,
as producer, and I was really excited. And then he called me the next day and he said, you know, I can't do it. I know you'll say you'll get my coffee and my cleaning, but I'm just uncomfortable bossing around someone who'd been, you know, head of business affairs. I can't do it. And I don't think anyone's going to do it. So either make a fake resume or figure another way to get the movie business. And so then a producer I knew was making a movie, and he said, why don't you come and help do the music clearances? Now, the music clearances,
right,
that has to do with
yeah,
the rights when you put music into any kind of audiovisual medium. And so I thought, okay, fine, I'll just do that, and I'll learn movie making that way. And then it just turned out, when I did that, which was on a movie called Beyond Therapy that Robert Altman directed, and Stephen Haft was a producer who had given me that gig, I ended up talking to Robert Altman a lot about different ideas of things in his movie musically, and it just turned out that I had some creative knack for oral-visual combination, using music to enhance storytelling and emotional beats. And it was like, wow, huh, that's cool. What's that called? Maybe this is interesting, I think I want to do more, but with this, putting music to movies, and that's kind of what happened. And then the next film was a movie called Hairspray, the original one, not the remake.
Mm.
And in that film, the producer, Stanley Buckfall, brought me in, and I had to do everything. I had to do the clearances and work with John Waters on the creative. And so through that process, it was like, okay, this is really, for me, not this clearance part. I don't want anything to do with this stuff. Mm-hmm. This doesn't work for me. And then I knew a woman who worked at TriStar Films, and she was wanting to leave. And I said, come join me. You can do the clearance business end, and I'll do the creative end.
Mm.
Her name was Jill Myers, and that's what we did. We formed this little company, and she handled all the music clearances, and then I never did again. I just was involved with the whole creative end.
Mm.
So it kind of happened sort of organically.
Yeah.
And accidentally.
Yeah.
I mean, and kind of accidentally.
Hmm.
So it's interesting it's gone full circle, and that now I'm involved now in producing movies. But now I learned about producing movies from being on the crew for so many years in every step of the trenches.
Yes. Yeah. For our listeners who perhaps are not that familiar with what a music supervisor does, I'm wondering if you could give us some insight into the scope of your job, because I think for people who do know or think they know what it is, they tend to think it's about choosing songs for a soundtrack, which I understand is part of it, but only perhaps a small part of the full scope of what a music supervisor might do.
Okay, I can try and do it with, say, Cliff Notes, because
yes,
I actually teach a course. It's 10
yeah,
weeks long.
Yeah, no,
music conversion, but I can
just the bullet
you,
point version.
It isn't just your viewers, but even filmmakers and people in the industry at large are not really clear of what a music supervisor is.
Right.
And that's also because it has evolved. But originally, when I started, and predating me, like in the old days, let's say Clark Gable films, you know, in the 40s, uh-huh, there was always an in-house, quote-unquote, music supervisor at each studio.
Hmm.
And basically, the music supervisor is really what the words say, supervising all the music to do with the film, whatever that may be. So those, a lot of those men, and mostly men in the old days, it was pretty much about the score and the sound. Today, or what I've done is, as a music supervisor, I'm responsible for every step of the music from beginning to end. And that could mean different things on different movies.
Mm.
So for a movie like My Best Friend's Wedding, which you referenced, I don't know if you saw that film. Did you see that film?
I did, yes. A long time ago,
okay,
but yes.
You know, they break out and they sing I Say a Little Prayer. There's different scenes where people actually sing, even though it's not a traditional musical per se. So I started that movie 6 months before we started shooting that film. And sat with P.J. Hogan, the director, going through the script, designing these numbers where people were going to sing songs. So then we'd figure out what songs they're going to sing, and then we'd send it off to the clearance people, of which I'm not,
mm-hmm,
as I mentioned. And then once they get the rights and then everything's fine, then we work out how to create the song, what it's going to sound like creatively, what the tone will be. And then I might find a producer to produce it, or I might do it. On that movie, it was a man named Eddie Arkin, a brilliant jazz musician and producer. And then we create the track. Then we decide if actors are going to sing it and which actors. If they can sing, we'll record them actually singing. If they can't sing, then there's another step where we bring in a dialogue coach to hear the actor speak and a vocal coach and a vocal contractor to then help me find singers in town who might sound like them. Mm. So that if you put that record that singer, it's very believable that it's the actor singing. And so believable that, in fact, when you're on the set and shooting it, the crew thinks it's actually the actor singing.
Wow.
So there's a process to that. So I'll have a vocal contractor who actually sit and listen to the actor speak and then find me a singer. So then we'll record the singer and the singers and the musicians, and then the next step is we get it to the actors to study it. Because mostly in musicals where people are singing, it's generally pre-recorded. And the reason it's pre-recorded, and this will be hard to describe on the telephone, but the reason it's pre-recorded is that when you see a scene in a movie, it's usually created from about 10 different shots, different camera angles, and it's all cut together to create that little section, let's say that little story. So if someone was going to sing live every time, and you had to cut together 7 different camera angles and different shots, it might not match. Mm. Even Barbara Streisand, one of the most perfect singers, might not sing the same every take.
Right, yeah.
So you pre-record it so that you have an actual viable recording that you can chop up and match perfectly every time. Mm. So the sync is really important because it has to look like the actors are singing and they have to nail it perfectly. So we give them a lot of time to practice. Mm. And I have stories that I won't share now of actors who thought they knew it and then they didn't, and different difficulties of working with actors lip-syncing.
Yes.
And then the next step is then I would be on the set. And I'm the one responsible for watching that the lip sync is perfect, which sometimes also is a very difficult position to be in because the director is watching for a performance. So the director may feel they got a perfect performance from that actor. Mm. And then I have to walk over and say, excuse me, they're out of sync and I can't fix it. Because, you know, there's certain sync issues you can fix with a music editor. They can move a few frames of footage to get something perfectly in sync. And then the director will get angry at me because it's like, well, you know, the director's really happy that he finally got the perfect performance by the actor and now it's not good because I've ruined it because the music's not good.
Right.
I mean, I technically didn't ruin it. I'm just, you know, the messenger, you know,
yeah.
They say don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah.
But that's been a really difficult situation on a number of films that, you know, I won't reference right now, where it's been really tough with some serious superstars who are out of sync. Anyway, so then we get that part done. So now we shoot the movie and everything's fine. Now the movie's done. The shooting of the film is done, and we move into post-production. So now you have this movie that has no music except scenes perhaps where people are singing,
right.
But there's no music. Oh, most people cannot watch a movie silent. If you were to try and watch an hour and a half film with no music, you wouldn't make it through it. I mean, people are not aware of it because if music is done really well, it's subtle.
Yeah.
And you're not focused on the music, you're focused on the storytelling. And the music is just there to enhance the storytelling. So now we have this silent movie. So I have to figure out what that musical tone will be. So then we do what's called the temp score. Temp is short for temporary. And we look at music from all over the place. I usually will have a music editor with me. And together we create a version of music to help tell the story that's a model. Mm. And sometimes that can take months. I mean, I'm working with Nancy Marsfield and Andrew Silver, the music editor who works with Nancy a lot. We spend months. We can try 100 different pieces of music for one little, you know, 30-second piece of dialogue until we get it right. It's not an easy process.
No.
Sometimes it's very smooth, and sometimes it's very difficult, and you have to figure out the tone. And sometimes you think you know it before you start. I did a movie years ago called Tank Girl, which is basically sort of like a from a punk rock comic book.
Yeah.
And Rachel Talley, the director, and I, we were convinced when we started this movie that the composer... But the score portion of the movie would be a really traditional classical score, like a 100-piece orchestra, like an old-fashioned score, counterpointed against all these sort of punk rock songs we knew we were going to create. Mm. Right? We were convinced. But once we started temping the movie, it totally didn't work.
Mm.
And luckily, we hadn't hired a composer in advance, because sometimes you can hire a composer in advance. And luckily, we hadn't, because it would have been the total wrong direction. We instead hired a composer named Graham Revell, who wrote more of that kind of score, who came from a band, who wrote more kind of rock, musical-type interesting music and not traditional composition, which he also can do. But in this case, we hired him for that skill. And we would never have known that. We learned that through the temping process when we were putting in traditional classical scores, and it just wasn't working.
Right.
So the temper process is where you're experimenting and figuring out the tone of the music.
Yeah.
And then you hire a composer, or if you're going to get original songs written, this is when you would do that, the next phase.
Right.
So now the composer comes on board, and if you're a full-blown music supervisor, you might go to the composer's house. The next test is, is what's called spotting the music. And that's when you and the composer and whoever the editorial team and the director go through the entire film, frame by frame, discussing what kind of music should be there. And you'll use the temp track, like, okay, see how this is here, this piece of sad music? I kind of like the sad music, but really it should be a little happier. Like, the director will give those kind of creative notes. Or this feels like a minor key, and, you know, and not in musical terms. I mean, the most important thing I find that I tell a director, because directors sometimes, some of them are very musical, but some of them are very uncomfortable and nervous about music. Like, it's not their area.
Right.
They're worried they can't speak the language, and I always tell them, don't worry about speaking the language. Just communicate what you want the audience to feel in that moment, what mood you're looking for, what emotion you want, and the composer will translate that into music. You don't have to say, do it in the key of C, or, you know, just talk about the feeling, what you want.
Yeah.
So anyway, next is the spotting. You almost be bored yet? We'll be done in another 30 seconds.
Okay.
And then after that comes up, post-production, where you sit and the composer might, mock up a piece of music, and you'll sit with the director and say if it's working or not, and he'll either rewrite it or not, he or she, depending on the music. And then they record the music, and you're at the scoring session as the music's being recorded, which is when the musicians are all playing music against the picture, like the film runs.
Uh-huh.
They don't know that they're playing it. Inside the booth, we have the picture. The musicians are just playing it for the first time, and they are extraordinary musicians. And never having done almost 80 movies, I still am like a kid in the candy store in every scoring session. I still cannot believe that these people are looking at this music for the first time and play it perfectly. It's amazing to me.
Yes.
Anyway, and then that's done, and then the recordings get done, and then you're in the final stages, which is called the mix, and that's when you sit on a stage and the movie, you mix the dialogue and the sound and the music all together to get the volumes equal against the picture, and then you're done.
Wow, that's quite a process.
I don't know if any of that makes sense to you. I've probably spoken a little bit of technical terms, but I was trying to do it fast and a little more layman-esque, and I'm probably just confused you more.
No, I think that was gave a very good picture of what it means to be a music supervisor. And if you just joined us, I'm talking to Bonnie Greenberg, who is an award-winning superstar music supervisor, amongst other things. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland.
Imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Bonnie Greenberg, award-winning music supervisor, executive music producer, jewelry designer, and college professor. And you recently worked on the controversial documentary The Hunting Ground, created by Kirby Dick, whose previous film with Amy Ziering, The Invisible War, was nominated for an Oscar. And The Hunting Ground is about the problem with sexual assault on US college campuses and how it's nearly always swept under the carpet. I was wondering what kind of soundtrack the filmmakers envisaged for the film and what your contribution was to shaping how the music ended up for the film.
Sure. I do just want to add one thing to our last before the break. We talked about music supervision.
Okay.
I do want to make that clear that that was about feature films, because there's a whole new breed of music supervisors with television and video games that really are more about finding really great songs. And there's people that say that television is the new radio, that, like, when I used to do it, artists did not really want to be on television. They thought it was beneath them. And now artists really want to be on television because it's how you get to mass amount of people with really interesting, cool music. So in those fields, they may not do the same steps that I laid out.
Oh, okay, interesting. So, thank you for clarifying.
And having said that, onto The Hunting Ground, the original plan when I was contacted was to create one amazing song that could hopefully serve as the anthem for the movement of the film, that could reach people and touch people on a really guttural, emotional level. And maybe people who might not be able to be reached through the film would be reached through music and vice versa. You know, like all the different senses we can be reached through. I mean, the reason why music is so important in films, it's that extra level of another emotion that gets hit through, you know, whether it's subliminal or consciously, the music impacts you. Mm. So the original plan was just to get one song fit in for the film. That's it. But then I ended up getting more entrenched with the film and did work with the composer and some other things. But just to get back to the song, so I had to come up with an idea and really think of who I thought could really write this powerful song. Because frequently on movies where I'm getting original music created, I might do what's called spec a song out, which means I will contact 10 writers, 20 writers, 30 writers. On some movies, I mean, on My Best Friend's Wedding, we had 110 writers, you know, who will try and write a song knowing that only one of them will get the gig. But it happens a bit in the industry. We call it a spec. So we give a total description of what we're looking for, and then someone tries to write the song. But in this case, I wanted to first see, I had an idea of someone based on some things I'd read about her personal experience. So I contacted the great songwriter Diane Warren, and she wrote an incredible song called Till It Happens to You. But when I got the song, I thought it was brilliant, the demo. And the demo, for those of you who don't know what that is, it's sort of just a mock-up of a song. It might just be someone sitting at a piano. It might be someone strumming a guitar. And it could ultimately turn into a song with a 100-piece orchestra and a totally different rhythm and a totally different tempo. Like if you think of a song like Yesterday, all those different versions you heard of Yesterday, right? The range of how a song can be done. So for Kirby, this concept was great about having a song be an anthem, but putting it in the actual body of the movie was a different thing. He didn't really perceive that. He's a storyteller of realism. He makes documentaries, and those are not necessarily the kind of film that you think of a song being part of the storytelling. The story is told by the people being interviewed and by the narration and the voiceover. But when I got the song from Diane, it was so incredible. I had this vision of one of the lead people in the film. The story follows Andrea. I can't believe I just forgot the other girl's name. Oh my God, this is horrible. Oh my God, I'm nervous being on the air. I'm forgetting name. Oh my God, this is terrible. Anyway, two girls who Annie, Andrea and Annie, who have taken on the cause of rape on girls and boys on campuses. They discovered, they came up with this idea that you could sue schools through Title IX for they're not being equally treated, women and men, and people being treated unjustly. So they've gone around America to these different schools. So there's a scene very early on in the film where we're introduced to Andrea, and she's telling the story of her experience of what it felt like when this man sexually assaulted her. And I had this idea that this song was so powerful that if we did a very stripped-down version and had these words which says, you know, till you, it's basically till it happens to you, till you've walked in my shoes, you know, you can't really understand my experience. That's the concept. And so I brought it to Kirby, and he said, no, I can't have music playing here. I said, please, let's just try this. And so Diane and I would do different demos, and I worked with the editors, and we cut it around, and then finally Kirby said, oh, my God, you're right, this is incredibly powerful. This is a whole nother level. And we altered the footage a bit, and we redid the song, and we did with the idea that it would fit in this spot. And it was a very emotional, moving, powerful thing. But we really needed the same song to be an anthem and an uplifting, empowering song at the end of the movie. Not a woe is me thing, but like,
right.
Oh, we're taking care of this. We are going after it. Do not screw with us. We will fix this system. We will change the world. So it's hard to picture a song that goes, till it happens to you, you know, like this very somber, moody piano to turn into, till it happens to you, you know, like taking charge.
Yeah.
And so and they couldn't imagine it. The filmmakers, you know, no, Bonnie, that can't happen. I said, I promise you that can happen. No. Now, all due respect, they are filmmakers, and many people can't hear what a song can turn into. You know, they're brilliant filmmakers, but that doesn't mean they can hear music.
Yeah.
So I said, Diane, we need to go back in and make another demo showing this in a, you know, an empowering version, you know, powerful and anthemic. So then we demoed another version and gave it back to them. It was like, oh, my God, you're right. And then that we discussed getting Lady Gaga had just come out publicly that she'd been raped. So then we went to Lady Gaga to see if she was interested, and then she came on board.
Yeah.
And when she was doing the version in the movie with the piano, I mean, she literally was crying after it. She was so moved just singing it. She was crying.
Oh, well, I would like to play the song. So just for listeners, this is Till It Happens to You, which appears in the documentary The Hunting Ground, which is going to be aired on CNN on the 22nd of November. It has been in cinemas, but it is now going to be on TV on CNN on the 22nd of November. So you can see the documentary then and also hear this song, but we're going to play it now. So this is Till It Happens to You by Diane Warren, performed by Lady Gaga.
And this is the end credit empowering version.
You tell me it gets better in time. You say I pull myself together, pull it together, you'll be fine. Tell me what the hell do you know, what do you know? Tell me how the hell could you. Hold your head up and be strong. 'Cause when you fall, you gotta get up. You gotta get up and move.
Until you walk where I walk, it's just all dark.
Well, that was the Amazing Till It Happens to You by Lady Gaga, written by Diane Warren, which was developed by my guest from the arts this week, Bonnie Greenberg, music supervisor, to appear in the film The Hunting Ground. And I just want to give you more information about that. You can go to the website, thehuntinggroundfilm.com, to get more info. And again, it is going to be aired on CNN on the 22nd of November. So I would watch out for that. You can also go to YouTube and check out the video of the song, Till It Happens to You. It's received over 20 million views with no publicity. It's a very, very powerful statement, and I would recommend that you go and see it, and also to watch the Hunting Ground, which, you know, is sobering but also inspiring in what young women and men are doing to try and change this situation. So we're coming towards the end of the show, Bonnie, but I wanted to ask you, all art is about communication, and communication that's often indirect, nonverbal, visceral, rather than simply direct and verbal. In your work, are you concerned about the message that projects you work on are delivering? Is that something you consider when you take something on?
Oh, absolutely. And that's particularly The Hunting Ground. I mean, I specifically got involved in this movie to try and just... to try and actually make a difference in the world. And I did want to quickly say something about the song that you played it. If you listen to that song, you can see it evolves. It starts off as a victim, speaking very sadly, you know, song like what, then it turns to survivor and then activist. There's a growth in the song that mimics the growth in the movie and to these individuals. And the little strings even at the beginning of that weren't even part of the song. That was scoring the call to action that ends at the movie. But it was so powerful that it was kept. So the song actually mimics the experience of the film and of these people and these survivors of what they'd gone through and taking on the cause. So when you listen to it, you can actually hear the growth of the song, which is all part of, again, developing it. But yes, I mean, I pick projects based on what they do for me, except sometimes there's filmmakers I've been involved with, so I will do their film no matter what. Mm. But I'm very much just particularly now about the impact. I tend to just be involved with documentaries now about causes and things that I believe where the music can make a difference. Like, this song has really impacted a lot of people. Andrea and Annie, the girls who started this whole movement, wrote a letter to Diane and Lady Gaga saying what this song did for them and what the lyrics, how the lyrics were the first time that anyone truly captured their experience. And that sometimes now when they can't talk to people, they just play this song. And this song exposes what it feels like to be in those shoes, how people always think they can tell you how you're feeling, what you're doing, and it's very hard to tell them, no, you can't, but you hand them this song and they can hear it.
Yes. Yeah, it's incredibly moving, and I know you spent an incredibly long time getting it to the point where it's, you know, totally evocative of the experience of these young women.
Yeah, it took about a year. So I definitely do think some people reach through music, some through visual imagery, some through art, some through films, you know, that their art can be captured in so many different ways, and different individuals respond differently. Someone may see a painting and it doesn't affect them at all. Someone else may hear a song. There's no way of knowing what art reaches what individual on what level.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, you have done so much in your life and are doing so much that we haven't been able to cover it all, but I did want to mention to listeners, you know, that you do work as an artist with jewelry design. You created a special piece, I understand, for The Hunting Ground. You're training as a therapist and currently working towards your license. So you're still continually learning, as I said earlier. I think your career is very inspiring.
Thank you very much. That means a lot, hearing that. I'm blushing. Luckily, we're on the radio and not on air, so you can't see me.
And also, this show encompasses a balance between the intellectual and the creative in it. It seems to me that you have utilized both the left and right brain in your life and in everything that you're doing as well. So that's an interesting parallel with the show.
Yes, and that was definitely inaccurate. I hate to sound so lame, but I am a true Gemini that way, you know, where, you know, multitude of interests and both creative and intellectual, business and creative, and I try to balance them. Sometimes it gets a little overwhelming, but I try to, and yeah, it's interesting listening to your show, the same thing, how you split up your show that way.
Yeah.
And I do recommend that everyone watch The Hunting Ground. It's a very important subject, and individuals can make a difference in the world, and it really helps you see that and know that maybe you can too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time, Bonnie. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
I look forward to listening to more of your shows. They're fabulous.
Well, excellent. Thank you very much. So just thank you. Just to let listeners know again, you can go to thehuntinggroundfilm.com to get more information on that documentary. It's really worth viewing, and it is going to be shown on CNN on the 22nd of November. And again, if you wanted to check out the video for the song that we heard, Till It Happens to You, it's on YouTube. And if you purchase the song from iTunes, the proceeds also are going to charity to support endeavors to deal with these issues. So I would also encourage you to purchase the song. Again, if you want to hear this podcast again or any other of my previous shows, you can go to my website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can also connect with me there on social media.